Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Today, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rigor fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Today, we'll explore the world of gridiron grace. Welcome to Gridiron Grace Football History and Memorabilia on the Gridiron Grace Publisher and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We'll cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. Find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine. A football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larson. He hails Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this week.
Bob, great to be back. Good to hear you. Happy Super Bowl week, as I call it, man's holiday, Super Bowl Sunday.
It was a very interesting Super Bowl with some minor controversy at the end. However, the game was won after 60 yep. minutes of battle. And as I said to several people who are Eagle fans here locally, Philadelphia had more than ample opportunities to win the game throughout the entire game. And I think it was just a question that we saw Philadelphia basically implode the second half of the game, and they pretty much rolled up and died. The defense, I don't know what happened to it. I really don't. I mean, it was an amazing way for the game to end. I also make the comment that if Kansas City had made that field goal beforehand, it would have been a moot point at the end of the game with that holding penalty, and that's it. So it's interesting, very interesting. One comment I got to make, though, because a couple of people asked me about it. They said, what did I think of Philadelphia going on fourth down for first down so many times that it did? And I said, I made two comments with regards to it. I said, it's a gutsy move, and, you know, I know you're playing to win, so on and so forth. The one thing that really kind of concerned me about watching the Eagles play, it seemed the bulk of their offense is on Hurts himself, running with the ball. And at some point, you really hope that guy is not going to be tackled the wrong way or hit the wrong way, and it puts him out of commission. You know what I mean? I mean, he had three rushing touchdowns, the two-point conversion, and I'm saying to myself, okay, is this the offense of the Philadelphia Eagles, you know, directly around him? You know, we're looking at a 1930s, 40s offense here with the quarterback in a formation just running every play. It's amazing. It's really amazing. Didn't make a lot of sense.
No, any offense that relies on the legs of its quarterback is rolling the dice every time that quarterback, you know, rounds the tackles. It's a matter of time before somebody catches up with them, somebody catches them from behind, somebody catches them from the side, and if that's the entire weight of the team is being put on those shoulders, then, you know, without that, then you're in trouble.
I mean, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Look at the 49ers.
And I was really, really surprised for a Super Bowl just to see that was basically the Eagles' offense. And if that's the case, you know, I think the guy should reexamine it a little next season. So, again, like you say and I say, the quarterback doesn't get seriously injured and he's gone. And that's it. It's done. You know? So, but anyways, congratulations to the Chiefs again. Second Super Bowl, and I got a shout out to the Nick Aguirre family. Congratulations on the birth of twins, which I guess happened the day after the Super Bowl. So he was a pretty proud papa out there, knowing his wife was getting ready to deliver. Congratulations to the Aguirre family, the longtime supporters of the magazine. And I think I'm glad to see everything went well with mom and the babies. So congratulations again. Another point tonight, Hall of Fame class of 23. What do you think?
Oh, guest on a couple of weeks ago talking about the Hall of, you know, the Hall of Average, the Hall of Below Average. And I think with every Hall of Fame year that rolls around, there's mixed bags. I mean, everybody has their advocate. You know, we saw most of these people play. But let me run down the list a few. Rondé Barber, you know, obviously we got to see him play a lockdown kind of, you know, cornerback, 47 interceptions, three-time All-Pro, five-time Pro Bowl, All-Decade Team of 2000. That's quite a resume. Three-time All-Pro. Is up there. That's the best in the NFL for three of his playing years, and to be all decade for 2000 is quite a notch on the resume as well. I think that's a yes, an easy yes. Don Coryell. I grew up watching Eric Coryell. I was a Seahawks fan growing up, but I was also a Chargers fan because I love Dan Fouts' drop back, straight back. I always wondered how he didn't trip on his own feet. Kellen Winslow, John Jefferson, Joyner, Chuck Muncy. I mean, you know, think about that. I mean, just Eric Coryell, I still get goosebumps thinking about, you know, 400-yard days were an average day at the office for, you know, for that offense right. back then in the 70s and 80s. You know, John Jefferson. Right. Yeah, just. Obviously, yes, revolutionized that West Coast offense in the passing game. Chuck Howley, finally, this one was amazing. It stunned me that he had to wait this long. Five-time All-Pro, six-time Pro Bowl, Super Bowl V MVP, still the only player on the losing team of the Super Bowl to be named the MVP. Imagine that.
Right.
Imagine what that takes. Chuck Howley, long time overdue. Five All Pros, even back then, is huge. That the oversight for Chuck Howley not to make it. Darrelle Revis, four-time All Pro, seven-time Pro Bowl, All Decade of 2010. Darrelle Revis introduced the term lockdown corner. I mean, he was that island. I'll never forget him. It's just that you didn't go after him. You didn't throw to an entire side of the field because he was over there. you know, Ed Reed, Darrell Revis, I mean, these guys, you know, Troy Polamalu, these were the guys that revolutionized the defensive game. Four All-Pros, seven Pro Bowls during the time he played, and he named All-Decade 2010 during that entire season, you know, that entire era. Pretty amazing.
Right.
DeMarcus Ware, right. Obviously, not even a second doubt. 138.5 sacks in his career, four-time All-Pro, three-time second-team All-Pro, nine Pro Bowls, All-Decade 2000s. That is the Hall of Fame. And so I ran down the people that were the obvious, like, yes, they exemplify the Hall of Fame. That's why we have it. And then you kind of get into these are the above average. Joe Klecko, Ken Riley, and Zach Thomas. I remember watching Zach Thomas play. Maybe I'm a West Coast bias. Zach Thomas was amazing, above average. And maybe he's that bubble. I'm sure I'm going to get, you know, some flack here for saying he's on the bubble, but, you know, amazing. Ken Riley, 65 interceptions in his career, one-time All-Pro. When I was collecting Hall of Fame rookie cards, he was on my sheet. I needed his card, but he was always one of those players where he was just way down the list. One All-Pro in your playing time doesn't quite make the Hall of Fame. And then, obviously, Joe Klecko.
I think in Riley's defense, he didn't play for a lot of great teams, but obviously,
yeah.
You know, he did show something on the field. Klecko, I watched because of New York. You know, I watched a lot of Jets games over the years. Klecko was a New Yorker. I mean, he was a New York type guy who went out. You know, he reminded me of a guy with a lunchbox that he would put his lunchbox on the bench. And go out and play and then, you know, eat his lunch in between plays type of thing. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I do agree with you. There is a bubble there with those three guys one way or the other. And, again, you know, like we talked about before, it's always a stretch. You know, for whatever reason, they're pushing guys, you know, who, yeah, maybe they should be there and maybe they should not be there type of thing.
Yep.
And by your analysis of what, you know, of their backgrounds, their careers, you know, it says something there. You know what I mean? So
yep. And Joe Klecko's good. Two All-Pros, four Pro Bowls. You know, had his jersey retired in New York. I mean, two All-Pros is there. That's pretty good. I've always considered three kind of to be the minimum. I don't know. That's just purely from a data point of view. I don't know. I mean, Zach Thomas is another one. I mean, solid Hall of Famer, all-team or all-pro five times, second team twice, seven Pro Bowls. I mean, good, just solid. I remember watching Zach Thomas, like I said, and he was good. But there's this West Coastness to it where it's like you remember how good he was. And then we switched from Miami over to New England chasing that ring.
And the same thing with Klecko. Klecko always had the New York City media bias, media influence. And like I said, he was a working man player, so that's why everybody loved him type of thing. So obviously that helped him get into the hall. Shifting gears real quick, you had mentioned prior there's some interesting Hall of Fame rings for in auction, I believe, at Heritage. What'd you pick up on that?
Yeah, totally. I was asking you before the show, some of the best, you know, hobby talk that we have is the minutes before the show when we catch up. There is this really got my eye. 1968, this is in Heritage coming up. It ends in, I think, 9 days. 1968 Bart Starr Super Bowl II Green Bay Packer Super Bowl ring, and then it says salesman sample ring, and this has Bart Starr's name on it. Got the three diamonds. It's got the score. It's got everything. And I was asking you what a salesman sample was because I didn't quite understand the terminology.
the salesman sample, basically the ring company would make actual samples of different models of the ring that the team could model it on. And they would go around and show, in this case with the Packers, they would always show Lombardi because Lombardi had pretty much the final say on all the rings. And they probably would give him, if memory serves me correctly, 2 to 4 different designs. He had his own idea of what he wanted, so he would kind of give them feedback before they would design the ring, and the samples were created. How many samples were created? Seems to me the Packers had a ton of salesman sample rings for whatever reason, and they made it back to the market, into the market lately, and I do see them. But, you know, to me, to have a Bart Starr anything as far as the Super Bowl is concerned, related to the Super Bowl, is to me very valuable and very very rare also at the same time. I would not say in any way, shape, or form, I can't see any of Bart Starr's real personal memorability going to the market anytime soon, even with his past. I really believe that's going to stay in the family. You know,
I don't collect the rings, so I wasn't familiar with the phrase. I mean, I've seen the sales and sample before. I just never knew what it was. There's a 1970 Baltimore Colts Johnny Unitas Super Bowl V sample ring, the Bart Starr 1968 Super Bowl II one I mentioned. There's an actual Super Bowl 26 championship ring presented to wide receiver Troy Brown from 2001 New England Patriots, their first Super Bowl. What a Super Bowl ring! I mean, the culmination of your, you know, of your career. Troy Brown is a good wide receiver too. It's at $10,000 plus the VIG. There's a William the Refrigerator Perry, and they say huge Super Bowl ring, Super Bowl 20 sample ring again. And then there is one other one, a 1965 Green Bay Packer NFL Championship ring. This is the actual one, 1965 Green Bay Packer NFL Championship ring, pre-Super Bowl, presented to Hall of Fame halfback Paul Hornung. This is Paul Horning's actual ring, and it's got his name on the side, his number, character and dedication laid on it, Green Bay 23, Cleveland 12.
Wow.
Pretty cool.
Great stuff. Great stuff. We'll see what happens. One of our next shows, we'll be talking about where those prices ended up on that. But now our special guest is here, and I'd like to welcome him to the show. Our special guest tonight, the great-grandson of the 1906 professional football world champion, Massillon Tigers captain, Bob Schering, who is regarded by many as the greatest center of the pre-NFL professional era. He's a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and lives in Watersound, Florida. He's also a graduate of Georgetown University and the founder and president of Integra Valuation and Advisory Services. Due to his love for family sports in his hometown, he spent 15 years developing his new book, Gridiron Legacy. He is also the executive producer of a related television miniseries in development. And I'd like to welcome to the show this evening, Mr. Greg Fleischery. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Bob, how are you? You hearing me okay?
Yep, coming in loud and clear. Thanks for being on. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule and spending some time with us and your new book. And I want to lead off by asking you if you could tell our listeners about your great-grandfather, the very, very famous.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob. It's a pleasure. So Bob Schering was, as you said, he was the captain of the 1906 world champion Massillon Tigers. And from 1903 to 06, Massillon won every state/world championship of professional football. And those are the years that he played for them. He was imported by them as one of the first four ringers, professional players to come to play in Ohio from the Pittsburgh era after 10 years of the first 10 years of professional football, as it turned out, from Pudge Heffelfinger being the first paid pro player in 1892 for the Allegheny Athletic Association. And until 1902, when the Pittsburgh Stars slash Pros were the last pro team in Pittsburgh in that era. And my great-grandfather also played for the 1901 Homestead Library and Athletic Club World Championship team in Pittsburgh, and for that 1902 Pittsburgh Stars team, which included Christy Mathewson, one of the greatest baseball players of all time. So basically, I grew up knowing just little bits and pieces from my grandmother and about his professional career, and that was sort of animated by a few pictures that she had of his teams, one of the Homestead teams from 1901 and the 1905 and 06 Massillon Tigers team pictures on her basement wall. So they were very sort of haunting, the looks on their faces, these big, strong, tough men that look pretty brutal, but just inspired a lot of questions, just wondering what it was all about. And so that was in the back of my mind, you know, for my whole life, until the opportunity came to really research and develop the whole story, initially just for my family as sort of a genealogy project about, 15 years ago, into what turned into this sort of national scope project and sort of changing the narrative of the pre-NFL era, according to the Hall of Fame and several other people who've reviewed it. So it's been a wonderful journey, long journey, challenging, but very, very rewarding.
Wow. Mm.
Unbelievable. The interesting part to me, though, when we got your name from John Wilkie, who's a mutual friend of ours, and he was talking to me about it, and I said, wow, yeah, I'd love to, you know, doing a little research on this, you know, reading your website and a few other places. I was just shocked. And again, here's a classic example of an unknown part of early professional football history actually gets researched and actually gets documented, and we can learn from it. And that's, to me, just the amazing part of something over 100 and how many years ago can actually be developed and actually be the story be retold and preserved for history. Great, great information.
Yeah, it became pretty clear to me, you know, pretty quickly that this was, you know, a huge opportunity. And I didn't look at it, you know, like a business opportunity, but just as an inspirational project to share with the world something that's so little known as the origin story of our most popular sport. So the name of the book is Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. So, I did what research I could to see what was out there, and Joe Horrigan from the Pro Football Hall of Fame and Bob Carroll before he passed away from the PFRA, they quickly validated that what I discovered initially in 2007, which was sort of the launching point for the project when my grandmother died and we cleaned out her house, and I found a whole box full of more very special photos from my great-grandfather's playing career, team photos, individual photos, small group photos. Some had names on the back, some didn't. I needed some help identifying them, and Bob Carroll was super helpful with that. And he told me I had to get out to see Joe at the Hall of Fame and share all this with him. And they were just slack-jawed. They're like, who are you? And, you know, we don't have anything from the pre-NFL era, Harley. This is really special. And, you know, if you can combine that, these photos with, and complete the narrative that's really missing also about the pre-NFL era and this sort of cold case of this alleged gambling scandal in 1906 between the Canton Bulldogs and the Massillon Tigers that really ended pro football for about 10 years, you'd have a really special book. And then on top of that, everything that I discovered along the way just even added more interest and intrigue to the story. So lots of discoveries that changed some historical beliefs and facts along the way.
Hey, Greg, this is Joe. I'm the co-host here. Thank you for coming on the show and discussing your book, by the way. Your landing page for your book, Gridiron Legacy, is awesome. The video you have there that's embedded in the website, first of all, handsome man, and I love that background you have there with three killer, just historical photos in the back. I mean, you mentioned the project, I mean, and on your landing page there, it's a project inspired by long-forgotten photos found in your grandmother's basement in Pittsburgh after she passed away. I mean, that's obviously how you decided to write it. Were you a football fan prior? What was it like opening this box and seeing your great-grandfather and just uncovering all this history?
It's hard to describe the thrill of that. I mean, I love sports, you know, first of all, and I love playing pretty much every sport. At an organized level, I probably tried every sport but football because I was a twig as a high school kid. I probably weighed about 135 to 150 pounds in high school. So I became a college tennis player, you know, when tennis was big in the 70s and 80s. But I love, you know, Pirates, Penguins, Steelers, and some connection in the family to the roots of football. It's just super intriguing. And before the internet, you felt like I'd probably never be able to really learn much about this whole story. But there were a few books done back in the 70s, coffee table type books, all black and white pictures. And my grandmother showed me one that was written by Robert Leckie. I can't remember the name, maybe the Illustrator's History of Pro Football, something like that. And it had his team pictures, a couple of them, in the book. So I knew this was real. She wasn't just, you know, exaggerating something, that it was significant. But just not a lot there. So, you know, maybe a couple pages at the beginning of a, you know, longer pro football history book with the early Super Bowl era and so on. So there was clearly a lot more to be developed. There was never really been a big full narrative on the pre-NFL era, at least, especially with any, you know, color to it, because as I said, everything mostly black and white. But as I was able to add a lot of collectibles and memorabilia, you know, visually to the story of the pictures of the players, I was very intentional in trying to create something unique and special and colorful, more colorful than has ever been done before. And I got some nice feedback lately from somebody just through Facebook that said that they were so pleased with the quality of the book when they received it, that it was like a museum, you know, like walking through a museum from cover to cover. So I think it's pretty special.
By the way, Greg, that title, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story, that absolutely grabbed me when I first read it. How did you come up with that book?
It was really hard coming up with the right title for the book. Over time, I can't remember. Different people had inputs. Originally, I was going to call the book "The Hero's Journey," but that really didn't connect to football. It had, but there's, if you're familiar with the concept of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey in mythology, there's sort of the journey of, it's almost like the field of dreams of football. And really, the parallels are magical to me. That if I were Kevin Costner, I sort of followed this calling to discover all these things and reveal the story of these football players sort of coming through the cornfields in Canton, Ohio, wanting to be, you know, their story to be told and to be forgiven for being accused of fixing the championship games like the Black Sox did in baseball. And, you know, maybe something that they didn't do, but because the story had never been told. And so the biggest discovery in terms of fact and narrative in the story, and I don't want to give, you know, spoil the whole thing, but I discovered a court file in Stark County in Ohio that had the depositions from people involved in this case in which Canton's captain, Blondie Wallace, sued the Maslin team and newspaper and owners for libel for accusing him of colluding in this scandal, and it ruined his life. And it never got to court officially because the official story was he ran out of money and couldn't pay his legal fees. But people still assumed he was guilty. And he went down in history as a bad guy and became a bootlegger, which added to his criminal reputation, and went to jail, you know, and so on. But and died of liver disease at a very young age, tragically. But the deposition reveals the facts behind the case that are very different than what was told in the newspapers. No surprise, and it's a really fascinating sort of revelation of this cold case, and that adds to the uniqueness of the book, along with the photos and some other things I discovered that I think we'll get into in a minute.
I just pulled out of my bookcase here that book you were talking about, the illustrated story of professional of football, and my copy is a first edition from 1969. I had this when I was a kid. The Story of Football, I'm sorry, by Robert Ledbetter.
Right.
And I read that book, I don't know how many hundreds of times. I just went through the front part of it again, and I can see how some of the photos will parallel what you were being shown at the time by your family there. And it's just some amazing. I can only imagine finding photos like that and out of a family heirloom. And it's just amazing to me, amazing. So along those lines, do you have any interesting stories about when you were writing this book that you could share with us in relationship to the development of the book?
Yeah, so many. We don't have enough time, but I'll try to pick the best ones. From a personal standpoint, I mean, developing a relationship with Franco Harris, who wrote the foreword for the book, was so special. He was so good to me and kind and genuinely interested in the story and helping however he could, which is just, you feel like but he did that for so many people. But, you know, the time that I got to spend with him and iterating on his writing of the foreword and some ideas and was really special. And it was a really heartfelt, couple pages that he wrote, and how he connected with the story, and really was such a passionate football historian. So we had lots of great conversations about what he liked about my writing and the stories that I told, and how it related to how much he loved football. So I guess in summary. So that was special. In terms of the memorabilia and things that, discoveries that you like to talk about on your show, the Hall of Fame now has in its displays two trophies that I found that it calls the first two known pro football championship trophies. And these were from the Homestead teams from 1900 and 1901 that I discovered in their storage closet in this, what's now called the Carnegie Library of Homestead, that I didn't piece together until somebody tipped me off that it was the same facility that used to be called the Homestead Library and Athletic Club. And when I got there in 2012 and toured it with somebody that used to work there, eventually, after sort of being disappointed that they didn't know anything or have anything about these teams that they sponsored that were the world champions for 2 years, we got into their storage closet, and there they were on a shelf gathering dust. You know, they had no idea what they represented. But I had seen a picture of one of them in an old Pittsburgh newspaper from 1901, and so I recognized what was sitting right in front of me. And then a couple of old trophies down from it was one that looked like a football, shaped like a football with two handles on the side and a lid on the top. And it was the one from 1900. So
talk about,
the excitement of a discovery. Wow. I mean, I called the Hall of Fame on the spot, and they said, send them out. You know, they knew everything about the Homestead teams, and they call them the Holy Grail of pro football. It's the chalice, the chalices of the game. So that was from a, I don't want to say collecting standpoint, from a discovery of a historical artifact that's so meaningful to the game. I mean, The 1901 trophy still sits in the rotunda in the first exhibit in Canton, along with the birth certificate of pro football, the Heffelfinger accounting ledger from the Allegheny Athletic Association in 1892, and the other one from 1900. I understand that I haven't been there yet, but there's a branch sort of the Hall of Fame in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina now. And that there's a sort of a mini Hall of Fame there, and the other one is there. So looking forward to getting there.
That's really cool.
Wow.
Jeez.
I gotta check that out. I'm about like an hour and a half from Myrtle Beach here. And I gotta see that. That's amazing. I gotta research that.
Greg, again, your some of the pictures you have on, again, your website. I mean, I'm a big Jim Thorpe collector, and I've got a couple of photos and, you know, cards from him in 1907. And it's kind of interesting because one of the photos you have on your landing page is the Canton Bulldogs from 1906, Canton, Ohio. And then there's a Thorpe, I mean, in the top row, which is always, you know, throws people off. But
it does throw
so
that. Tom Thorpe,
find.
Not Jim Thorpe, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I've bumped into that a few times as a Thorpe collector. You're like, oh my gosh, 1906 Thorpe. And you click on it, you're like, ah, damn it. You know, come on, guys.
Yeah.
Throw a first name in
there.
Yeah. But
there's no E on the end of Tom Thorpe's last name. And he played at Columbia, I think, in college.
Yeah. The 1915, whatever you want to call it, 1920 pre-NFL stuff is so hard to find. And you've just got photos of the Tigers of the Bull. I mean, it's incredible what you have. I mean, to say your great grandfather played a historical part of football history, I mean, is an understatement. I mean, as you're digging in and researching for this book, what part of his career stood out to you and your family that just stunned you?
I think the most amazing and sort of impressive fact to me is that growing up in Pittsburgh, you know, he only finished the eighth grade, and like many young people did then, and just had to go to work to support the family. And that he found his way into amateur football and up into professional football, first with some of the top amateur teams in Pennsylvania, the one called the James F. Lallis Athletic Club. They became known as the East End Athletic Club, and they played Homestead in 1900. And because there weren't enough pro teams for the pro teams to play a full pro schedule, they played colleges, amateur teams also. And they invited him because of his excellent play in their 1900 game to join them in 1901 to go straight to the best team in the country. And that from there, that he continued, eventually started for them in late in the year, and then in the 1902 Pittsburgh Stars team was, one of their center also. He played the center position. And then to be one of the first four to be recruited with three of his teammates from that team to go to Ohio with the Massillon Tigers. Eventually, staying with them through 1906, the only one to play with them all 4 years, being named the captain in 1906 of the world championship team, again, with only a grade school education amongst the best all-American Ivy League educated players in the country, said so much about his character. And I think that's the most valuable legacy that he left as the patriarch of our family, was his character and honesty in this what was known about the gambling scandal of 06 was that he was the first player that the gamblers approached to try to get his team to fix the games with Canton. And that my grandmother even knew that bit, that he refused the bribe and reported it to his coach and who reported it to the management. And it still kind of all blew up on them as they tried to figure out how to navigate the situation without letting the fans know what was going on. And it all kind of got out anyway. But I think that's the most like satisfying thing that I've learned about and I appreciate about him.
That's really cool. we have another friend of the show, Michael Moran, and his dad, Hap Moran, played, you know, football for the Giants, and it's always fun to say he his family is, you know, kind of NFL history, and, you know, it's kind of the same thing here, just to recognize just how part of NFL history, pre-NFL history, for that matter. I mean, this is way before NFL history, so that's just really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is a good point, Joe, because, again, we're hearing pre-NFL history here, and I don't think a lot of people are aware, except, you know, longtime collectors, historians of the game, realize the implications of that betting scandal at that time and what it actually, you know, what it actually did to the game at the time. And, you know, it's been argued over the years, did that really stop professional football from being formed, because it was, you know, people thought it was a crooked game type of thing. And, you know, fast forward to 1919, the Black Sox scandal, and the problems that baseball had. It's just kind of amazing to me to, you know, hear the actual story of what happened and, you know, what players, you know, did about it at that time too, because, again, you know, they weren't making a heck of a lot of money, and you know, if you got an opportunity to make a few more bucks, you know, this is what you're going to do, and that's it. So that
right.
to me is a very, very amazing part of this entire story. And again, I don't think enough people, except people like us and you know, PFRA people, really know anything about it at that time. So it's pretty interesting to hear from a family member of what he actually did during that crisis at that time. That's amazing. Truly amazing.
Yeah, I think if you had to pick a guy, you know, whose perspective you wanted to you know, view the whole story from, it would be Bob Schaering, because he, of his progression from, you know, from Pittsburgh through the Ohio, he was on like every major team from, you know, basically 1901 to 1906. I mean, they won every world championship, but and being the captain and the focal point, you know, the initial touch point in that scandal. But I really tried to touch in the book how prevalent gambling was all around, you know, that time, from those early years in the 1900s, even through the Black Sox. And I'm sure, you know, it's never stopped really until today, but through Prohibition and everything else, it was kind of a sort of a lawless time in a way. It was the Wild West in pro football, especially there were not many rules and structure to a league or anything. Players jumped from team to team, week to week, a lot. But there's even a picture in the book that was one of my favorites of Christy Mathewson playing baseball, where he was warming up before a game and throwing in front of a big sign on the side of the field that said "No gambling allowed." So, you know, they had to keep gamblers out of the baseball parks. And there's even a story about the 1903, the first World Series between the Pirates and the Red Sox. Gamblers tried to bribe Cy Young, I think, was to fix those games. And he told a story about how he told them to get lost. But there are a lot of other stories that I've pulled from the newspapers about how the players, you know, there's still a lot of gambling amongst the communities, you know, between Canton and Massillon residents and amongst the Pittsburgh communities on their hometown team. It was just normal. And the players, even the ones that had the best reputations, like to pool money together to bet on their teams against, you know, either not other players or on the other teams or other people. Funny story, when the Homestead team went to Philadelphia to play in 1901, and the Philadelphia gamblers wanted to lay money on it, and they came to check out the Homestead players in the hotel as they walked through the lobby one night in their uniforms, and one of them poked at one of the Homestead players, and the player just poked him back a lot harder, and apparently the guy decided to put his money on Homestead instead of his Philadelphia
people after he, you know, saw how big and strong they were and how well they practiced and so on. So they were all about, you know, trying to make a few extra bucks. I think they could make more money, you know, on the side than they could in their football salary.
Wow. Unbelievable. It's interesting, you know, memorabilia. We love memorabilia. We collect it. It's historical.
Yeah.
Yep. Question for you. Have you tried to collect actively items from your great-grandfather's career, and or do you collect anything in general as far as football memorabilia is concerned?
Right. Yeah, anything and everything related to him, his teammates, teams that he played, amateur, professional, photographs. My first goal was to get a photo from every team that he played on in every year, and I was able to do that except for maybe the really unknown earliest amateur teams. But from 1899 through 1906 or 7 at least, I have photos of his team. So that was a big accomplishment, and some of them came from collectors that I made friends with over the years, and they knew what I was interested in, and they would give me a call when they found something that they knew I would like and knew I would pay too much for. So that there was that, and then other things came, like programs. Finding a program from the 1901 Homestead team was an amazing find from another one of those same collectors. A 1905 Maslin Canton program came from a Maslin resident that I met through the Maslin Museum out there. And then the big one was finding one of the 1906 Game 1 programs between Maslin and Canton. I actually found on eBay several years ago. That was incredible. Other little things would come up, like pin ribbons, just with a Tigers, you know, celluloid pin with a black and gold, black and orange ribbons on it, or one really big one that had all the names and the games and scores on it. And there's just other photos of individuals, or sometimes a little individual award I've found on eBay that Peggy Parrott, who was alleged to have thrown the first forward pass, you know, I found a little trophy that he was awarded at one point, or David Fultz, who was the captain of the Homestead team, another little cup that he was given. So I try to find postcards, you know, I have a lot of stuff, and the Hall of Fame would like to have it all at one point. So, sure, I'd love to show it all to you sometime.
I mean, that's stuff cool. Is exceptionally rare. I mean, to find anything like that is
harder and harder to find, for sure.
Yep. Bob and I have talked a lot about, you know, paper drives of the wars, about just how newspapers in general, you know, just any paper, you put it in an attic, you know, and it gets scorched by the heat. You put it in the basement, maybe it's moisture or mold. Just how many fires in houses, how many floods. And for a paper, a photo, a newspaper cutout like you have of the Massaloni Morning Gleaner, you know, how something like that can make it 117 years, and survive. I mean, it's incredible. It's such a lucky journey.
Yeah, a few years ago, one of the last pieces to the puzzle was a good picture of the 1902 team from Pittsburgh. I only had one out of a Pittsburgh Press newspaper, which, you know, had been yellowed and so on. But I visited my great uncle one time, who was my grandmother's youngest brother and the last surviving sibling in the family. And he was so touched by my project that I was working on. He went into his bedroom, and he was in his late 80s probably at the time, and came back out with this oversized, incredible picture of the team, picture of the 1902 Pittsburgh Stars team, and matted on I guess they call them cabinet photos, but big photo, like 24, you know, 18 by 24, maybe bigger. The funny thing about it was that
the image was reversed. It was like the P's on their jerseys were backwards. I'm like, somehow it got printed in reverse, but I was able to have it restored and, you know, flipped and put it in the book. It's an amazing picture.
Wow.
Hmm.
Well, unbelievable.
I love it. Well, Greg, love hearing your, you know, your summary, but what are your, some final thoughts on your book? And then tell us about how people listening in can find your book, order it, buy it, you know, and somehow put their hands on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now it is only available on the book's website, gridironlegacy.com. You get a signed copy for $50. And for the time being, and by the fall, it will be available on Amazon and all the major book retailers' sites, where it's currently available in a pre-order phase, but they have an annual cycle I've learned about that they have to go through to get the books in their warehouses and make them before they're available. So we're going through all that now, and it will be – but you can't get the signed copies, you know, like you can through my site. But so that's how to get it. It's been a journey of trying to figure out how to bring it out and launch it to the public. It launched in September, big party I had in Atlanta, or living at the time. And I've done what I can to do a bunch of podcasts, book signing events, and presentations in Ohio and D.C. and Atlanta, some upcoming in Pittsburgh. And just wherever I can, but I'm a sort of a one-man band, and I've hired a digital marketing company that's doing a great work on the website, and did a Facebook ad campaign that's about to close now that the Super Bowl has happened. But it's gotten great exposure, sold over 1,000 books, which I think is pretty amazing, without a major publisher behind it.
Yeah,
but we'll see where it goes, and I'm excited. Every day is a new, you know, chapter in the journey.
Wow, that's an amazing amount of books to sell as a private publisher. I my hat's off to you. That's incredible.
Thank you.
Great job. Great job.
It's touched the nerve, you know. And it's not just about the football facts and history. It touches a family history nerve in people that when they just hear the word great grandfather, they say they get goosebumps. And that's, I love it so many times. There's something that we're wired about to appreciate our ancestry. And I think that's what makes it really cool.
Yeah. On your landing page, three great endorsements from some Pittsburgh greats, Franco Harris, Rocky Blyer, and John, I'm going to murder his last name. He's actually the only one I haven't heard of, John Frenchie Fuquois.
Well, John, he was the other guy in the Immaculate Reception who collided with Jack Tatum and when the ball bounced back to Franco. So they're sort of last ship to hit. And I met them together, you know, at Franco's 40th anniversary Immaculate Reception party. And he loved the story too. So we stayed in touch, and he gave me a nice quote also.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Greg, I've taken time out of your schedule. And again, it's going to be a great book that people are still going to be seeing and reading and buying in the future. And I wish you all the best with it. And quick question to put you on the spot. Second book out there on anything, or what do you think?
Possible that there's a novel at some point. A publishing company's wanted to develop it as with all the dialogue of the characters. That's on the table. And there's also a miniseries on the table. We have a written script for a 6-part miniseries we're trying to get picked up. So lots
great.
Of possibilities.
Great. Sounds great. All right, Greg. Thank you for
being
on. We appreciate it. And best of luck.
Thanks. Hope to meet you in person sometime. Take care.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Unbelievable. That is living football history.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Literally just, you know, I bring up, you know, Rev Moran, you know, just he is football. I constantly make that, you know, he is football history. I mean, yeah, this is right behind it. That's pretty cool. I wonder, I meant to ask him which side of the family his great-grandfather, you know, Bob Shearing was. It'd be interesting to know. Different surnames, obviously. So.
Yeah. But again, just to uncover all that information and to find those photographs and everything, just what a story. That's so nice to hear. And again, it's preserving the history of the game. And that's what we've been doing for a long time now. Again, here's another example of, you know, something you never would imagine is found, and a story can be written on it, and the history is preserved again. And that's what it's all about. And, you know, not to beat up a dead horse, but, you know, the NFL really needs to understand it has a really long history. It has a real involved history. It has a history of other leagues. It has a history of pre-professional football.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand, you know, I get all the marketing, all the garbage of dollars and cents all the time, the multi-gazillion dollars that's in the game today. But if you're not going to, if you're going to ignore, and if you're going to continue to shortchange football history, I don't know what you're trying to prove by doing that. I really don't get it. I don't understand the marketing behind it. And again, I know I'm biased because, you know, I've lived football history all my life. And as I get older and I'm looking at things and I'm viewing things, I'm saying I just don't understand why they treat the game the way they treat it. You know, Super Bowl is a classic example. You know, drives you crazy. You got commercial after commercial. Flow of the game is always interrupted. You got a Super Bowl halftime show that is borders on a pornographic. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, it could be such a nice game played, and you know, and it's a real chess match out there. And what is it? You know, it's just a slick marketing tool, and that's it. And it's wrong. It's really wrong. And you know, I'm not afraid to say it. I've been saying it for years now. That's the way I feel about it, you know? Unbelievable. Truly unbelievable.
Yeah.
Oh, we're getting down to 2 minutes. Getting down to 2 minutes. Yep. Sorry, 2 minute warning. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
What a great guest. Thank you for inviting him on. So many questions. Sometimes it's like we have to keep it along the script, but there's so many little tangential, you know, questions I want to ask. And, you know, like last guest talking about the Hall of Mediocrity, and, you know, that ended up being the,
yep,
you know, the kind of the lightning rod for the show. What a great guest and good book. Just a good looking book.
Yep.
I love the title, as I mentioned, just Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. And he's absolutely spot on. Absolutely right.
Exactly. Great, great historical view. Very refreshing. The family lineage. It was just great. That's a great story. I can't express it any other way. It's a great part of football history being preserved. It's essential to keep the game preserved in that manner. And I'm glad we now have a published book on it and expanding that area even more than what we limited knowledge we had about it up to this time.
Totally.
All right, down about a minute. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Check out our website and subscribe today. Final thoughts, Joe. 20 seconds.
Good to be back. Super Bowl. Man, love Super Bowl time. Just love it. It was a beautiful day here. Love it. Great show, Kevin.
Yeah, we had a nice time with the game, watching it, and I enjoyed it. And I, you know, deep down, I'm a fan of Andy Reid. You know, here are two guys. Me and him were the same age, been through the mill. You know, he's got a second ring. I'm real happy for him. Great team too, at the same time. All right, we're almost out of time. We'll be back hopefully the end of next week with another show. We've got a very special guest we're working on. We can't disclose at this time. Still working on him.
Excited.
We're getting on the show, and hopefully we're going to pull it off. And until then, hopefully, like I said, we'll be back the end of next week with another show. Thanks for listening again. GridironGreatsMagazine.com.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.